good morning, and welcome to week four. I was worried that because of the rain, people would stay away. A couple of people did, but it's great to have everybody here once again. For week four of Jew of the Future, I should note, I put it at the top of the sheet, I gave you the link there, that the dates are now set for the classes at Beth Emeth for this coming year. And for September, we're going to have a two-parter. As I mentioned last week, the Book of Jonah, More Than a Fish Story. We'll be talking about lessons in a variety of spheres, personal lessons, spiritual lessons, political lessons that emerge from the Book of Jonah. Registration is now actually available online, and there are a whole bunch of other classes that are already set. What I hope to do is to send out the email as the follow-up from today. I'll include in there probably a list of the classes for this coming year, so you can mark it on your Wednesdays as when to be out of town. Something else I wanted to mention. Oh, right. Yes, please remember to silence your phones. That was the other one. Always have to mention that. Thank you. So we've gone a few different directions in this series, right? The first class was on mitochondrial replacement and the question of determining maternity, right? Is it the woman who carries the baby to term? Is it the woman whose egg it is? Is it the woman whose mitochondria are involved? Then we talked about genetic screening and PGD, and that's actually going to come back into play today. And then we went into artificial intelligence, and does an artificial intelligence need to observe Shabbat? Is there an obligation not to have it do work on your behalf, even if it doesn't have its own obligation? And now we get to predictive algorithms, or as I titled it on the sheet, fortune-telling, horoscopes, and predictive algorithms. And we have a couple of different directions I want to go with this today. But I want to start out with just what exactly are predictive algorithms, also known as predictive analytics. And you can figure it out just from the term itself. Prediction, right? That's your first word. And then an algorithm is a method used, more or less, is a method used to solve a particular problem given the data. So it's the, go back to my computer science days. I know we have other computer scientists here, but to go back to my programming days, the algorithm was the method that you use to crunch the data and reach the result. So take a look at source number one. This I found to be a very good, simple explanation of what it is that we're talking about. Predictive analytics is the process of using data analytics to make predictions based on data. I love definitions that use the term itself as part of the definition. Nonetheless, I still felt it was relatively clear. This process uses data along with analysis, statistics, and machine learning techniques to create a predictive model for forecasting future events. So you're analyzing the information from past events, hopefully looking at it based on context. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And using it to generate predictions of what is going to happen in the future. The term predictive analytics describes the application of a statistical or machine learning technique to create a quantitative prediction about the future. Frequently, supervised machine learning techniques are used to predict the future value. How long can this machine run before requiring maintenance? Or to estimate a probability. How likely is this customer to default on a loan? Really, it's not all that different from anytime you're teaching a machine to analyze information and come to a conclusion, right? An example that I like to use in different contexts, it happens to work very well. When I was in grad school for computers, that was one of the key developments of that time was development of optical character recognition, in which a computer could scan a page and figure out what the writing on the page said. Actually identify the letters on the page. So how do you teach a computer to do that? You teach the computer what features to look for that will help it identify this letter as opposed to another letter, or this letter as opposed to a blotch. and you feed the computer enough data, the computer gives you enough answers. You respond with yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, so that the computer learns what was in fact significant and what was not significant, and that way it's going to be able to analyze further writing on a page and figure out what the writing actually is. That's not predictive. That's simply the computer learning how to read. Right? No different from what we did, just a lot more expensive. Maybe not, actually, with our tuition. I don't know about that. But the point is that that basic process in which the machine takes in information and is taught how to analyze it becomes a lot more sophisticated and is now able to take in information about past behavior, behavior of the weather, behavior of the markets, behavior of human beings, and to attempt to use that in order to generate conclusions about what is going to come next. That's the idea. So this has many, many different applications. One application is clearly in business, and you saw a couple of illustrations already in source number one. It's used in military settings, right? Trying to figure out what the enemy is going to do and when they are likely to do it. How serious are they with this? Is this a bluff? What type of resources do they have, and where could they be deployed? It can be used with the weather. It's a whole host of different possibilities. One of the possibilities is in terms of police work. And this creates all sorts of ethical challenges. Now, I was emailed, a little while ago this morning. I was asked about a movie, Minority Report. Apparently, a Tom Cruise movie, in which they actually predict the crime, and there's punishment before the crime. Now, that's different from what we're talking about here. Not because it couldn't happen in some dystopian future. But because, honestly, that's less interesting as an ethical question. I think we have a knee-jerk response of, no, don't do that. Right? Don't punish people for a crime they haven't yet committed, even if we want to protect society. And yes, there will always be the extreme ethical questions. Would you kill baby Hitler and whatever? But generally speaking, we don't believe in punishing people who haven't yet done something wrong. However, some of the uses of this type of analysis for the sake of fighting crime pose much more interesting ethical problems. Take a look at source number two from an article in Maclean's. Predictive policing involves the use and analysis of data to predict where crimes are most likely to occur in the future. Various kinds of data are used, including numbers, types, and locations of past arrests, public reports of crime, requests for police assistance, neighborhood features such as bars and bus stops, and in some cases, weather patterns and lunar cycles, because that's a thing. Social media activity has also been incorporated. Based on the predictions, police agencies can increase patrols and allocate other resources to meet anticipated risks. Does it work? The evidence is mixed, but the future looks promising. So it's not about arresting people before they've committed a crime, but it's about making sure the police will be on the scene in an area where we anticipate that a crime will take place. That's interesting. Before reading the rest of the source, what do you think about that?
That's my card.
It is a lot like carding. That was my reaction when I read it. Yeah? Sorry? No, it's not. Why not?
Let's say there are a ton of shootings in a particular area.
Yeah.
Is there something wrong with having police, more police presence, if that area is known to... I'm not saying they should stop people because that's... If they stop somebody because they're a visible minority and they are driving a fancy car, that's one thing. But if they know that a certain area has a history, I don't see the problem.
So the question is, why is this any different from something that goes way, way back before modern computing, which is the police notice that a particular area is dangerous, there are a lot of shootings or whatever it is going on there, and they deploy more police officers in the area. I mean, that's common sense, right? One would think. Why is this different? Oh boy, too many hands. Okay. Okay, Lisa.
I wasn't answering your second question. I'm answering your first question.
Okay.
I think a better example of what we're talking about predictive is the things you see in cases of domestic abuse, where the police are close to home, maybe several times, and they know that eventually it's going to be a really bad outcome, but there's not much they can do to kill a crime that they know they can successfully charge the person for or hurt. So they have to wait for them.
Right, and that's the downside of an ethical system.
Yeah.
Right, is that, I mean, there are interventions that are possible, but not the intervention that is necessarily needed. Right. Yes, Sandy.
I think crime is non-intrusive and can be non-intrusive. And from looking at statistical analysis of the occurrences of security, if I was more in the class,
right, so I'm going to get away from the carding specific question. It was just something that was my gut reaction also when I read this. Let's take a look. Still a major concern, we're in the second paragraph of number two, is that predictive policing models will reinforce and exacerbate biases in crime data and police practice. When models draw on flawed or inappropriate data, they may recommend increasing police activity in neighborhoods with higher proportions of ethnic or racial minorities, not because the risk of crime is higher, but because the input data are biased. If so, our expectation that citizens be treated with equal concern and respect would be in jeopardy. In other words, we may think we came up with a really good way to crunch the data, but the data may be bad. How could the data be bad? Look at the example they give. A simulation study focused on drug offenses in Oakland found that a predictive policing model's algorithm would recommend sending officers mainly to African American and Latino neighborhoods, even though rates of drug use are essentially the same across Oakland neighborhoods. The model uses data on previous arrests by location, which are as if not more likely to capture patterns in police activity as they are the actual prevalence of drug-related offenses. In other words, if you arrest more people in this area, then you will send more police to this area. But the fact that you arrested more people there doesn't mean that that's the area that actually needs the police officers. It's hard to get good data. It's not a simple and straightforward thing. Susan and Lee.
But didn't we, okay, more than insurance, but actuaries. Weren't actuaries just people who are machines doing exactly what we're talking about?
I mean, actuaries are certainly involved in crunching data and trying to make predictions on that basis. Yes. And you have to a certain extent. I mean, the insurance business relies on that.
So really, what we're doing is using machines that may not have what a person has to expand and say, hey, that data always coming because we know that certain group of people live here, so their police are after them, whereas machines can't differentiate.
I mean, we have problems in terms of some of the things that actuaries do as well. The fact that actuaries do this doesn't necessarily mean it's an acceptable thing. In some areas it's benign, and in other areas it can be a really big problem in terms of people who are unable to get coverage because of decisions actuaries have made. I'm actually going to go a little further rather than take the questioning, and I apologize, but I'm just looking at the... All right, fine. I said your name already. Go ahead. But that's really going to be it because we got to get going.
First
yeah.
thing is nothing is absolute.
Okay.
The other thing is, even in all the literature we read, community is important. And if it's to protect the community at large, what would be leading towards the high risk areas?
Mm-hmm.
So you would have it for police. If it wasn't for Mr. Turing and the Second World War with the machine,
yes. The argument is not anti-computer. The argument is anti this particular use. And the argument is, number one, your data may be bad. And number two, you often lack context, which matters a great deal. And if you continue in number two, I'm not going to read it aloud in the interest of time, but he points out that the police officer who has now been informed of the conclusions of this data crunching is naturally going to digest information in his next encounter in light of what he's learned from the machine. So he sees a 16-year-old kid nervously cutting through a backyard. In this area, he's been told that's a dangerous area. That's where crime takes place. This kid is probably someone who just broke into a house or is on his way to break into a house, as opposed to this area, the machine says, low crime area, not an issue. So this kid is probably just somebody who's late to get to school. But, you know, that's not enough information. But that's the way that's naturally what you produce. And it affects everything in terms of the way you're going to deal with society and all the interactions that come from there. It can lead to error. It leads to a sense of victimhood by people who believe that they are being inappropriately, digested, if you will, by the machines. The fundamental point that I'm trying to make here, and really that the McLean's article is trying to make, is that it's not simple and straightforward. Even if we're not talking Minority Report, punish people before they commit the crime. Fundamentally, this is a really challenging issue, the use of predictive analytics to try to determine how to police. On the one hand, is a natural thing to try to do. It's an extension of what we do anyway. But on the other hand, it's really fraught. It gives us a sense of confidence in our conclusions and confidence in our data that may not really be warranted and can lead to real problems. That's an against side of things. Let's take a look at a positive approach to it. And this goes back to the topic from 2 weeks ago of genetic screening. We talked then, I'm not going to go through all of it now, about the basics of genetic screening. But in source number 3, we find the response from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, leading authority in Jewish law in North America in the, call it basically 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, until he passed away in 1986. And he was dealing with the question of couples being screened for Tay-Sachs. That was the question he dealt with. This is not the PGD discussion that we had 2 weeks ago, in which you're actually creating pre-embryos and then deciding whether to implant them or not. This is a couple who aren't even married yet, who want to be tested to find out, if we were to get married and produce children, what are the odds that those children would potentially carry or develop Tay-Sachs. So take a look at number 3, where Rabbi Feinstein writes the following. Since it is easy to check, one should realize that failure to check oneself would be like closing one's eyes before that which one could see. God forbid such an event, meaning the birth of a Tay-Sachs baby, would cause the child's parents extraordinary pain, and so it would be appropriate for a man who wished to wed a woman to test himself. It would be good to publicize this in newspapers and other media to alert people there is such a test. It is clear this must be done privately. That's a separate issue, the issue of who gets the information, who actually finds out the test results. But the point that Rabbi Feinstein is trying to make in number 3 is really in his opening sentence. He says, if you have the means of screening and you don't do it, you might as well be closing your eyes before you cross the street. This is a tool that we have at our disposal. It is a tool that is easy to use. Why wouldn't you do it? That's the position that Rabbi Feinstein takes. We have something, there's a term in Hebrew, which Ashkenazim will pronounce hishtalus. Right? Sfaradim probably will say hishtadlut. What does it mean to be mishtadel? To make an effort. To work at something. There are two poles within Judaism. There is the one pole that says, it's all up to God. Pray to God and God will take care of it. And then there is the other pole that says, I'm a human being put into this world to do. God instructed us way, way back in the Garden of Eden that we have jobs to do in this world. We're supposed to take care of it. We have things that are our sphere of responsibility. And the argument here that Rabbi Feinstein makes is screening, testing, and you can apply this to data and to analytics. It's just part of what we do. It's part of doing our job. And if you fail to take advantage of a tool like this, then you are to blame for the results. Two different angles on this. Talking about different cases. He's not talking about police work, and they're not talking about genetic screening. And that matters a great deal. I'm just trying to show that you can't do good, bad, black, white. It doesn't work that way. It's a more complicated issue than that. So what I want to look at, the questions I want to address are, First of all, is it ethical to use predictive algorithms to intervene before a crime has been committed? That's number one. Number two, the Torah has rules against fortune telling, as we'll see. Is use of these predictions somehow against the Torah's rules about horoscopes and so on? I grew up, reading Gene Dixon in the newspaper, but, it was fun. It wasn't like anybody actually read that and said, oh no, and, fill in the blank. I forget what she used to say, but it seemed very similar day after day. The third question is, how does use of predictive algorithms fit with Judaism's expectation of faith in God? Those are our three issues for which we have another 40 minutes. So, we spent a lot of time on the build-up. First of all, the ethics of the preemptive police work. So, in Judaism, you have two opposite imperatives when it comes to this issue. Imperative number one, protect society first. Worry about society as a whole, even if some individuals may suffer along the way. Imperative number two, on the other hand, is that we don't preempt and we don't prejudge. Let me go back to the first one. Anyone familiar with the case of the Ben Sorer Umore? That ring a bell? What's the Ben Sorer Umore? So that's a little bit of a power of explanation. If the child behaves badly, you have to take him in front of the rabbinical court. Take a look at source number four. This is the biblical text. When a man has a stubborn and rebellious son, in Hebrew, Bein Sorer Umoreh, who does not listen to the voice of his father and the voice of his mother, and they rebuke him, but he does not listen to them, his father and mother shall take him and bring him out to the elders of his city and the gate of his place, and they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He does not listen to our voice. He is gluttonous and a drunkard. That's what you're talking about. That's your case. Now, the punishment for this child who is gluttonous and who is a drunkard is death. Death. So now you have to ask yourself, what has he done to deserve a death penalty? What is that about? Ruth.
I understand that they go to great lengths to assume that he is not a drunkard or a glutton.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that explanation. We're not there quite yet, but you are correct. We're just not there yet. In general, the Torah's death penalty is exceedingly hard to the point of impossible for a court to carry out. In the sense that the requirements on a regular case, forget this case, but the requirements for a death penalty in general are witnesses who warned the person who was going to commit the crime right before the crime, like within 30 seconds before the crime, don't do it, and if you do it, you're going to get such and such a penalty. The person then has to say, I understand, and I'm doing it with that in mind, and then commit the crime. And the witnesses are then cross-examined in a court. And if the court wants to ruin their testimony, it's actually relatively straightforward. The Talmud describes one of the rabbis saying, I would test, if they said the crime was committed under a fig tree, I would test the witnesses and ask them what the thickness of the stems on the figs on that tree was. And they're quizzed separately. And if one of them contradicts the other, the testimony is thrown out. If one of them says, I don't know, the testimony is thrown out, right? We were watching a murder under a fig tree. We didn't think to stop and look at the figs. If they wanted to avoid carrying this out, it was fairly straightforward. All of this derives from a biblical mandate, because the Torah says, "Hitzilu ha'eda," that the judges are responsible to try to save the accused party. It's very hard to actually carry out the death penalty, but the question still is, so why'd you write it? Why'd you put it in there? What is this about? Well, take a look at source number five, the Talmud's comment on this case. Because this person ate a tartimar of meat and drank half a log of Italian wine, the Torah says that he should go to the court to be stoned. Is that really what you're going to do to him? Rather, the Torah realized the end of the stubborn and rebellious son's path. In the end, he will finish his parents' property and seek to feed his habit, and he won't find it. He will go out to a fork in the road and steal from people. The Torah said, let him die innocent and not die guilty. That's predictive policing, right? You're looking at his behavior. You're saying this is going to lead him to attack people by the highway so that he can get money to feed his habit. And yes, there's a lot in here about addiction. Those who were there when we did the series a while back on mental health, one of those was addiction. We talked about this at that point. But this is a statement of sacrifice the individual because we believe that otherwise he's going to be a threat to society. I see hands, but I want to go further here in the interest of time right now. I may come back later for hands, but not right now. Not only that, this plays out in a fascinating statement of Jewish law. Take a look at source number 6. Even though, we'll get back to this case of the Ben Sorer Moreh, the rebellious child, we have more to say about it, but take a look at number 6. Anyone who teaches a student who does not behave properly will fall into Gehinom, Gehinom being the term for hell. Anyone who teaches a student who does not behave properly is like one who casts a stone to Marcolus. Marcolus was a particular idol. Going back to Greek and Roman times, some associated with Mercury, others with others, but it was worshipped by throwing stones on a heap of stones. So the statement is that if you teach Torah to someone who is of bad character, then it's considered criminal to do so, and it's like worshipping idols. The idea being, I believe this was the Chasam Sofer who said, the Torah is compared to water. There's one passage in particular in the Torah in which we are told that the Torah descends like rain. It's a funny thing about rain. Whatever it lands on grows. If you have roses in your yard, then hopefully after today's rain, they will flourish. And they'll come out and they'll bloom and it'll be great. And all the roses that suffered because for the last week and a half or so we didn't have rain, now they're going to bloom really well. However, if you're a gardener like me, and what you have are weeds, then they too are going to flourish after the rain. I had a good spell of not needing to mow the weeds. But now they're going to burst forth in full whatever. That's the reality of it. Torah is like rain. If a person is of good character and approaches it wanting to learn good things and be able to do productive things, Torah will help them. But if somebody is looking for trouble, if a person is deceitful, if a person is somebody of bad character, then Torah is going to give them the means of acting on that, on acting on their worst instincts. So the statement is, if someone's of bad character, don't teach them. Instead, what your responsibility is, as Maimonides writes, is to first help them to improve in terms of their character. Then you can go back and teach them Torah. You don't abandon them. Yeah?
That assumes that the individual who is of ill character will never improve or change.
No, I'm going to make sure I say this clearly. As Maimonides says, you have an obligation to work with the person on their character. What this is actually, I think, a very important statement about the limits of what Jewish education can do. What it's trying to say is, you don't just throw books at them and say, this will help them become better people. You have to speak to their character first. And teaching them laws isn't necessarily the way to do that. There has to be character-specific guidance. Can Torah provide character-specific guidance? Yes. But one has to approach it from that perspective and with that angle and not simply say, let's bring them into yeshiva, give them an education just like everybody else is getting, and now they're going to be good. It doesn't work that way. And that's what the Talmud here is warning about. The whole topic of throwing somebody out of school is a whole other conversation, a fascinating one, but not for right now. The last point that I want to bring within this idea of protecting society at the expense of the individual is a law known as, in Hebrew, Baba Machteres. And what it means is, well, I actually brought it on the sheet in source number 7, if a thief is found while tunneling into somebody's house, right, the homeowner hears some strange noises downstairs, comes downstairs with a shotgun, and finds the thief, There is no blood, meaning he is entitled to, not only entitled to, he's supposed to kill the thief in order to defend his family. Now, you don't know for sure that this person who is invading the house came with intent to kill somebody. On the other hand, you don't know that that's not his intent. The general assumption is, and that's the assumption that Talmud makes in discussing this verse, that somebody who invades a home is ready to take a life in the event that they are caught. That's the assumption that is being made here. And the point, as explained by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in source number 8, he deals with this in a more updated version of things in a military setting. The point here is, no, you don't know with certainty that this is somebody who would kill. You don't know for sure what the thief would do if he were caught. And yet, you're justified in acting with lethal force in order to protect yourself from the home invader. That's the statement. All of this, everything we've seen starting from source number 4 and running through source number 8, argues that we are in need of tools that we can use to protect ourselves from people of ill will. And yes, it's not 100%. And yes, our calculations are not perfect. Nonetheless, we need to protect ourselves. That's one school of thought. But now let's go the other way, because nothing in Judaism is ever one-sided. It doesn't work that way. So here's the flip side. Story of Isaac and Ishmael, half-brothers, right? Both of them are sons of Abraham. So Ishmael is 13 years old when Isaac is conceived. He is 14 years old when Isaac is born. Ishmael is born to Abraham and Hagar. Yitzchak is born to Abraham and Sarah. Sarah realizes that Ishmael is a threat to her son Yitzchak. What was he doing exactly? Hotly debated. Everything from he was alleging that Yitzchak was illegitimate, claiming that Yitzchak was actually not born from Abraham at all, but was actually born from Abimelech, the Philistine king, who had taken Sarah captive. That's one possibility. To the other extreme, which is a midrash that says he was actually attempting to kill his brother Yitzchak. All sorts of different possibilities. Keep in mind, he's 14 years older than Yitzchak. So, Sarah says to Abraham at the celebration of Yitzchak's weaning, when Yitzchak is now, we assume, 2 or 3 years old, and therefore Ishmael is 16 or 17 years old, she says, enough of this Ishmael. He is not going to inherit with my son. He is not part of this family. He is a threat to Yitzchak. Get rid of him. Abram doesn't want to do it. God says, listen to your wife. Yes. You can take that out of context completely as an instruction for Jewish males for all time. Listen to your wife, God says. Fine. Hagar and her son Ishmael are sent away with some bread and water. They go out into the wilderness, and Ishmael falls ill. Ishmael is under a tree. Hagar doesn't know what to do. And at that point, they cry out, and take a look at source number 9. And God heard the voice of the youth, of Ishmael. And a messenger of God called to Hagar from the heavens and said, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, God has heard the voice of the youth, as he is there in Hebrew, Ba'asher hu sham. And God shows them a source of water, and they survive and thrive, and the rest is history. But the end of that sentence is interesting. God has heard the voice of the youth as he is there. That last bit, those two words, three words in Hebrew, Ba'asher Husham, doesn't belong. You should have just said, God has heard the voice of the youth. That's it. What do you mean when you add, as he is there? Talmud comments on it, source number 10. One is judged only based on his deeds of that moment. As it is written, God has heard the voice of the youth as he is there. In other words, Ishmael was guilty of terrible things before this. That's how he got kicked out. Nonetheless, right now, He's a 17-year-old who's crying out to God, I'm going to save him. That's the read of the Talmud here. The read is expanded upon in the Midrash, in source number 11. It portrays the malachim, the angels, saying to God, why in the world are you going to save him? Don't you know what his descendants are going to do to the Jews? The writers of the Midrash didn't know the half of it. What they're thinking about is the fact that when the Jews are exiled by the Babylonians, the Arabs don't help us. Take a look at source number 11. The angels leapt to argue against his survival, saying, Master of the universe, you would provide a well for this man who is going to murder your children with thirst? And God replies, what is he right now? Righteous or wicked? And they said, righteous. He told them, I only judge a man based upon his moment. Rise, take the youth, and so on. In other words, you go based on who the person is right now, regardless of where that will lead in the future. Yes?
Why is he righteous right now?
Just for the act of calling out to God for help. That's it. Just for the act of calling out to God. It's a really important statement. The Talmud has a line. This always gets a laugh. The Talmud has a line in which a man says to a woman, marry me on condition that I am fully righteous. And the Talmud says, even if he has been wicked up until that point, assuming she accepts, he is married to her. Even if he's been terrible until now. Why? Because maybe he had a thought of tshuva. Maybe he had a thought of repentance, and therefore right now he is fully righteous. So if he says, marry me on condition that I'm fully righteous, and she says, yes, now they're married. That's the case. Just wanting to be righteous is in and of itself meaningful. And there's a lot to be said about that. It's not for right now, but there's a lot to be said about that at some point. Right now I want to make sure to get to see this topic. The message here is, the overall message here is, you are who you are right now, not who you're going to be. And that plays out in Jewish law as well. Just as we said that there is a statement of don't teach the kid who has bad behavior, right? Don't teach him because he's going to misuse what you teach him. Take a look at source number 12. The issue of disinheriting somebody. One can write away his property to others, leaving his children. From a legal standpoint, in Jewish law, one is able to disinherit children. But the sages are displeased with him. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said he's remembered for the good if his children were not behaving properly. This is a dispute, and the ruling is against Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. The ruling is that we do not disinherit. Yes, I know, it's sort of a stereotype. If you don't do this or if you do that, then you're never going to see a penny or whatever it is. Not from a Jewish law perspective.
You just leave them your debts.
You leave them the debts, that's right. That's a different way to deal with it. But that was Marilyn's line, not mine. But the point is, Jewish law says even if your child is not doing what you want them to do, you do not disinherit them. You don't know what will come of them in the end. And as far as the case of the rebellious child, I wanted to come back to that. Take a look at source number 13. Because the Talmud asks the question, same question that we had in number 5. Because this person ate a tartimar of meat and drank half a log of Italian wine, his father and mother will take him out to stone him? Rather, it never was and it never will be. And the Talmud shows how the laws of the case are constructed such that it is impossible for this to ever be carried out. Well then, why is it recorded? What's it doing in my Torah? To which the Talmud answers, Drosh v'kabel sachar, learn it and receive reward. There are lessons to be learned from the passage, even though it is not meant to be implemented. What the lessons are, you know, again, a good topic for another time, but the point that I wanted to show you here is that this is a case that we're told is not, well, this is one answer. I thought I had another answer on here, and I see I didn't bring it on the sheet, so I'll say it outside. But the first answer is, it's actually not meant to be implemented. The other answer is a midrash in Bereishit Rabbah, which says that this case is different for another reason. This case is different. The Ben Soera Moreh case is different because God is telling you to do it. In other words, this is a statement. A voice from the heavens literally is saying to you, in this case, you know how things are going to turn out. Normally, you're not allowed to predict, but God is telling you, in this case, this is what is going to happen. Applying this to the ethics of relying on predictive policing and the challenge of the McLean's magazine article and saying that, you know, your data may be wrong, your algorithm may be wrong, you're going to bias people, you don't have context necessarily for that data, which is going to be really important. The argument on one side. And then on the other side, yeah, but I have a tool I could use to save lives. I have a tool that I could use to protect people. And really, this is what we always do, just without the benefit of a computer doing it for us, but we always try to predict future behavior based on past information. What emerges to me from this is the following. Number one, the Torah does not consider it ethical to punish someone for a crime they have not committed. Right, that's what we see in the Ishmael story. If they have not yet committed a crime, they cannot be punished unless you have a very specific divine sanction, like in the case of the rebellious child. But barring that, and even that is not necessarily meant to be implemented, you can't punish someone for a crime that they have not yet committed, even if you know where things are going to go. However, the ethic of protecting oneself, as Rabbi Feinstein put it, keeping your eyes open when you cross the street, is still important. Yes, the other person could end up not committing the crime. You still have a duty to protect yourself. So the upshot of this to me is that the algorithm is useful insofar as it's used to protect, but not when it crosses the line to be used to punish. And that's easier said than done, because realistically, some of your protective methods are naturally going to lead to punishment for others. I'm not pretending that this is a pat answer. It's not. But a lot depends on what the motivation is, not just in this, but in every area of life. A lot depends on why you're doing what you're doing. Yeah, of course.
The whole theory of rabbinic zeirut, that they set up a gather, like a call it a gather, like a fence around the Averos, so you shouldn't permit it. I mean, isn't that almost predictive as well? Because you're saying, no, I haven't really found the Averos, you haven't broken the laws of Shabbat, yet
they set up a Averos
that will be able to...
Right, I mean, that's... Right, Morris's point is not just rabbinic. It's a point about legislation in general. All legislation is predictive. Right? All legislation is predictive. Any society you are in that creates laws is trying to anticipate what the needs of society are going to be and what we need to do in order to avoid a circumstance in which one party is able to harm another, cheat another, or whatever you like. But all legislation is predictive. That's the game that it's trying to play. And rabbinic legislation absolutely fits with that. But I think it's important to stress, a lot of this really is about what you are trying to accomplish when you do what you do. Right? The church had a big problem with Exodus chapter 22, sentence 1, the case of the home invasion. The church had a very big problem with it because the argument was, I think it was Thomas Aquinas, I think, was the one, but I could be wrong, who said that if you are going to murder this person in order to save your life, you are still committing murder. And therefore, this is if you're familiar with the double effect, right? In philosophy, the double effect is where you perform an action which has two results, one of them negative, one of them positive. And the question is, so do you go ahead and do what you wanted to do, knowing it has a negative result, right? The trolley car case. There's a trolley car running down the tracks, and it's going to hit this group of people. However, you have the ability to flip the switch, and that will go on to the other thing, and it'll only hit fewer people, one person instead of hitting five people. So do you flip the switch? Thomas says, no. He says, you can't do that because you're killing somebody by doing that. To which my answer is, it looks like you have to look at your motivation. You're not trying to kill this guy. You're trying to save five people. You're trying to reduce the harm. That's really, you know, a case in which your philosophy, your motivation is significant. What are you trying to accomplish? And I think that's true here. The use of predictive algorithms for police work is justified when it is being used, number one, with a minimum of harm, to whatever extent you can minimize it, but number two, when it's done as a defensive technique and not as an offensive technique. There's a lot more to say about that, but we still have a lot to go, so I'm gonna move from this to the issue of omen reading. The Torah prohibits reading omens, trying to say, well, there's a black cat that walked across my path, and therefore I shouldn't go out today. You come up with your own favorite omen. Take a look at source number 14. Do not eat blood. Do not read omens or calculate propitious times. These are together because the consumption of blood was part of rituals of sorcery and the like. That's why they get lumped together. Do not read omens. Do not calculate propitious times. This time of day is particularly good for me to go out. Or this time of day you have to stay indoors. Or whatever it is. That's a verse from Leviticus. Reiterated in Deuteronomy. For you are entering the land Hashem your God is giving you. Do not learn to practice the abhorrences of those nations. There shall not be found among you one who passes his son or daughter through fire, the Molech idolatry, or engages in sorcery, or calculates times, or uses omens or magic, or one who practices charms, or inquires of Ov or Yid Oni. These are people who use animal bones to try to communicate with the dead. Or one who seeks to speak to the dead. For all who perform these deeds are abhorrent to God, and because of these abhorrences, Hashem is eliminating them from before you. You shall be complete with Hashem, your God. So if I'm not supposed to try to predict the future, then maybe I shouldn't be using predictive algorithms at all. If we had more time, I would throw this open as a question. And if I threw it open as a question, I suspect somebody would say to me, well, this isn't anything like predictive algorithms, because these things don't work. Right? This business of eating blood and engaging in sorcery and saying 11 a.m. is bad for me and black cats are bad for me and the 13th of the month, if it's a Friday, is bad for me. These are all nonsense. Computers, that's science. One would make such an argument, and maybe those who are in computer science will laugh at that and say, well, that's not true. But the faith that we have in the way programming works is such that I would look at this and say, this is entirely different, but you have to keep in mind something very important. Astrology back in the day was science. Astrology to them was a natural force. The belief was, and I brought it for you in source number 15 from Rabbi Moses Nachmanides, writing in the 13th century, most people believed, until very recently, that this was just part of nature. In the same way that a large body will act on smaller bodies with the pull of gravity, so too, Mars is exerting a force on Earth. It's somehow or other influencing whatever happens here. This was considered to be scientific. So why not, in fact, say all manner of prediction, including scientific prediction, is prohibited? Oh boy. Would that be a reason to prohibit predictive analytics? The answer is no. And the answer is you really need to go into the question of why we prohibit fortune telling. And I turned to Rabbi Moses Maimonides, who I should note did not believe that astrology was meaningful at all. He thought astrology was a joke. He went against the scientific grain of his day in that regard. But he said, there are two concerns here regarding this manner of telling the future. One he recorded in his Guide of the Perplexed in source number 16. The other he recorded in his work of law, the Mishneh Torah, in source number 17. In source number 16, he makes the point that the various types of predictions, and especially those using the stars, were used in order to keep populations in line historically, so that the ruling class would be able to say, our gods, who you worship in the temples that we have built, they have told you that you have to do this in order to get their protection and avoid doing that. Take a look at source number 16. When you read the books which I mentioned to you, you will find that witchcraft, which will be described to you, is part of the customs of the Sabians, Kazdim, Chaldeans, and to a higher degree of the Egyptians and Canaanites. They caused others to believe, or they themselves believed, that by means of these arts they would perform wonderful things in reference to an individual person or the inhabitants of a whole country. Although no analogy and no reasoning can discover any relation between these performances of the witches and the promised result. It is the object and center of the whole law to abolish idolatry and utterly uproot it, and to overthrow the opinion that any of the stars could interfere for good or evil in human matters, because it leads to the worship of stars. Maimonides here says their fortune telling that is prohibited is the kind that leads to a belief that there are powers other than God. That's what he says here. He says it was a system that was set up by human beings to support their own power structure, and it leads to belief in idolatry. Well, if that's so, predictive algorithms are not going to lead me to believe that something other than God created the universe. So, I think I'm okay. They may be wrong, but they're not going to lead me to some other religion. Look at number 17. He says, he gives a different reason for not following fortune-telling. All of these are words of falsehood and deception, all these types of sorcery, which the early idolaters used to trick the nations to follow them, and Israel, who are wise and educated, should not follow these matters of emptiness or put the thought into their hearts that these are beneficial. As it says, there is no omen reading in Jacob, nor sorcery in Israel. That's actually this week's Torah portion. Anyone who believes in these and similar matters, thinking in his heart that they are true and wise and that Torah prohibited them, is only among the fools and those who lack knowledge. In other words, what Maimonides says is that the reason you're not allowed to read omens and avoid black cats and the like is because you're not allowed to be foolish. That's what he says. He says if the Torah prohibits you from being foolish, it is a desecration of the name of God and the Jewish people for Jews to believe in this stuff. That's his explanation. So in other words, you're allowed to believe in it if it works. You're not allowed to believe in it if it doesn't work. That's his art. No, that's his statement. So, following this lead, following this explanation, there's nothing wrong with predictive analytics. Again, assuming it's right, which is tricky. There's a margin of error. But that's the idea. If it's not going to lead you to some other religious belief, and it's not going to make you look foolish, so then go ahead. However, there's one more issue. And this issue is very important, and it stems from what we've already said, but goes off in its own way. If you go back for a second to source number 14, where we have the biblical prohibitions against pursuing fortune telling. The last line, "You shall be complete with Hashem your God." In Hebrew, "Tamim tehyeh im Hashem Elokecha." There is a fear that looking for definitive information from sources other than God reduces our relationship with God. The method may work. It may give valid information. Not Maimonides' belief. Maimonides thinks it's all foolishness. But Nachmanides, for example, will say, these methods can work. They may well tell you things about the future that are valid. But pursuing it takes your focus away from God. It would be like if I wanted to be inspired and enlightened. And so in my pursuit of inspiration and enlightenment, instead of turning to the books that you see that line this room, I went to the bookstore and bought myself a self-help book. No, that's not a joke. That's not, the book may work. The book may provide practical insights and benefits which will make me a better person. But where will my Jewish identity be if that's what I look to for guidance? I'm not making an argument now for excluding all books outside of the ones that line this room. That's not what I'm saying. Let me be clear. But I think that there is a question that one must ask, which is, where do I get my inspiration? Where do I get my guidance? And I think that's a question that this forces. I see your hand, Ruth, but I'm just I need to make sure to get through this first. That's the concern for some people. Pursuing knowledge of the future from these other sources is going to increase their confidence in programming. It'll increase confidence in predictive analytics and decrease faith in God. One of the things that Tanakh, Jewish scripture, takes as a given is that God is able to predict the future, and it's what makes God different from all the deities that we encounter elsewhere. Such that we're always supposed to do, we're always told to do that which God has told us to do, and then rely on God for how it's going to work out. So in source number 18, I brought you something we discussed a couple of weeks ago. The story of Chizkiyahu. Chizkiyahu said, I didn't pursue having children because I had divine inspiration. I knew that my son was going to be terrible. And in fact, that is what happened. But the response of the prophet Isaiah of Yeshaya is to say, that's not your business. You have a commandment to do your best to try to produce children, and then it's up to God whether it's going to work out or not, or it's up to the child, because free will. But it's not up to you to be the one to determine that. The Talmud has another story in number 19, which in the interest of time I'm going to say outside of the text, but you can see it there. Rabbi Akiva, the famous Rabbi Akiva, the one who started learning when he was 40 years old, right, became a great teacher of thousands and thousands, one of the leaders of the Jews after the destruction of the Second Temple, the rabbi who was the main supporter of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. So he had a daughter. And one day, astrologers told him that his daughter would die on the day of her wedding. And the Talmud tells the story of what happened. The night she got wedded, she got married, she took a pin out of her hair and she stuck it in the wall. I guess that was the pin cushion. And the next morning, she finds that it has pierced the eye of a snake. And then they ask her, what in the world happened yesterday? What merit did you have that this would have done that? And she says, because everybody was all busy getting ready for the wedding. And they were ignoring this pauper who was standing at the gate who wanted food. So I went out and gave him food. That was what happened yesterday. So they said, see that? There's a verse in Proverbs, Tzedakah Tatzil Mimavet, charity saves, philanthropy saves from death. And lo and behold, it worked. But I bring the story not because of what happened for her in the end and the thwarting of the prediction, but because she got married. In other words, yes, Rabbi Akiva was told by the astrologers who thought they were providing him good advice, you know, on the day she gets married, she's going to get bitten by a snake. But he didn't stop her from getting married. He didn't say, I'm not going to do what I'm living life, and this is what we do. She's going to hopefully be okay. But that's what they did. They followed what they needed to do, and they didn't take their instructions from the astrologers. And Rabbi Moses Nachmanides, I think, Ramban, takes this approach when he talks about our concern about fortune telling. In number 20, Maimonides came up with a book in which he listed all of the Torah's commandments. And it's a very hard job, it's a discussion for another time. But he listed all the commandments. Along comes Rabbi Moses Nachmanides and says, you missed some. And he gives him a list of the ones that he missed. And the eighth commandment that he believes Maimonides has missed is in number 20 here. We are commanded that our hearts should be complete with God. As it says, you shall be complete with Hashem, your God. This command means that we should designate our hearts for God alone and believe that He alone creates all. He is the one who truly knows the entire future. From Him alone should we seek the future. And we should not seek it from those who gaze at the heavens and others, or we should not trust that their words will come true. But if we hear something from them, we should say, all is in the hands of heaven, for He changes the arrangement of the stars and constellations at will. And Abram received this command when God came to make a covenant with him and give him children, saying, walk before me and be complete. God said, Heye tamim, be complete with God. The view of Nachmanides is, the reason to avoid fortune telling is not because it leads to idolatry. The reason to avoid fortune telling is not because it's foolish and wrong. Rather, the reason is because it takes you away from confidence in God. Taking this now, and I brought you another source in number 21 where he talks about the idea that The mitzvah of prayer is fundamentally belief that God is able to help us, which is an interesting point that really deserves its own discussion. But applying this back to our predictive algorithm discussion, we don't prohibit hishtadlus. We don't prohibit a person from making the efforts they need to make in order to be able to live, right? As we saw before from Rabbi Feinstein regarding genetic screening, you don't close your eyes when you're crossing the street and say, "See that? I am demonstrating that I truly believe in God." That's a terrible thing to do. That's not where we're going with this. And we're not against either the idea that you find guidance in the world that goes beyond the books that are in this room. But the question is, where is your compass? Where does the direction really come from? When you ask yourself, you know, one of the things that I had to do when I was starting out in the rabbinate was the rabbinic grilling. It's done different ways in different communities, but basically when you want to go to a shul and interview to become a rabbi, a staple of that is the grilling, in which everybody gets together and they can ask you whatever questions they want. And it's a real barrel of laughs, I imagine, if you're not the rabbi. It actually is a lot of fun for the rabbi also, but he's laughing inside. But the questions are the most remarkable questions sometimes. But one question that's a serious question, and I think that synagogues should ask when they're interviewing a rabbi, is who are your role models? Who do you look to for guidance and as a model for what you should do? And it's a very good question, and one that always gave me pause. Like, you know, who do I look to? And I think to apply that here, it's really important that we make sure that the trust that we have in the predictive algorithm, the trust that we have in the technology, does not replace the confidence in the God who created the world and the God who is the God who is supposed to be our protector and the one who runs the universe. As long as the technology doesn't unseat God, I think it's very consistent with Judaism. It isn't the fortune-telling horoscope type of problem. So to summarize what we've said, and I realize I am 1 minute and 19 seconds over, so I'm going to do this quickly. That's the benefit of having a recorder. Number one, we believe that we do use this, including for the protection of society. We don't believe in relying on the predictions to punish people before their crimes, but we will use them to protect ourselves, like the business of not closing one's eyes, like the business of being able to protect yourself from a home invasion and not have to say, "Well, I don't know with certainty that this person would kill me, that the burglar would kill me." You use it for your own protection. You don't use it aggressively. This is not an issue of omen reading, according to Maimonides, because Maimonides says the concern with omens is they lead to idolatry or that they are false. Neither of those applies here. But we do need to remember Ramban and Nachmanides and his point, which is, fundamentally, our major allegiance still has to be to God. Use the tools, make use of them, but don't let them replace prayer, and don't let them replace your religious identity. That's what I would say out of this. Now, I am over the time. I will stick around and take questions, but I really don't believe in holding people late. Feel free to go. I'm going to follow up later today, God willing, with an email that will list the upcoming classes. Thank you so much for participating in the series.